statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government program. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll look back at some of our best interviews from 2012, featuring Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, Rebuild the Dream President and co-founder Van Jones, and Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. But first, a congressional roundtable on health care reform with Eleanor Holmes Norton of the District of Columbia, Donna Christensen of the U.S. Virgin Islands, and former Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. Congresswoman Holmes Norton, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. So good to be with you.
As the Supreme Court takes up the health care law argument starting today, what are you looking forward to most?
Well, remember, this is the first of 3 days, and this day may be the most important because it may decide whether this case gets decided at all, at least for now. This ripeness question, this question of whether it is ripe at this moment, because no one has yet paid the penalty or the tax according to which you believe it is. And generally, the court doesn't hear cases until some act has occurred that shows that the act is in full effect. So while it may be quite technical, it is very, very important. In fact, it is most important next to the individual mandate.
What can we expect in the days ahead in terms of the arguments?
Well, it's interesting that the part of the bill that is also being challenged as to whether or not the Congress can put other people into Medicaid, for which we pay part and the states pay part, no court has held that that is unconstitutional. So we're back to the so-called individual mandate. Can you have a health care system at all if they are free riders? And the individual mandate essentially tries to get rid of the economic, the financial fact that you and I pay $1,000 more annually for free riders because they decide to take their chances on whether to have health care.
What are you expecting from the court in this case?
Well, you know, nobody predicts this court. If you asked me, and I'm a constitutional lawyer before I came to Congress, you would find, in my judgment, this bill, this law, it's now law, is constitutional. And remember this, and the court may ignore this. After all, the court can do whatever it wants to do. But there is a rule of the court that there is a presumption in favor of the constitutionality of a federal act. Now, we've seen them overturn federal acts before, and I would like to hear how they would rationalize that. But this act is so weighty that the court needs to look at, and this is what it does, it looks at what kind of hearings have been held, what kind of factual basis has been laid for the bill, what kind of documentation is there for the conclusions reached, and if you can overcome that with a constitutional notion, then you can. In this case, there is something different about this case, and that is no one quite has an example where someone had to actually pay something. And so the court could use that as a way to say, well, yeah, there's a presumption in favor of the constitutionality of a federal act, but this is different. The Commerce Clause does not cover making somebody do something. And I think that they would find many precedents that were not quite this, but that led them to this. I also don't think they will find another circumstance where this will happen, because health care is unlike everything else in the market. Unlike everything else in the market, where you purchase it or not as you need it, health care is something you never know when you will need it. So that's why we have insurance, and that's why the bill has been developed this way. And do let me say this, that there is no country in the world that has health care, and most countries do. Virtually all the developed countries do, and most of the undeveloped countries try to have a national system of health care. All of them have a national system. Either it is based on taxes, or it's based on single-payer insurance. We would be the odd man out because apparently we don't understand the math, which is that the whole pool has to be in it so that everybody gets charged less.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. Congresswoman, on this notion of health care and not knowing when you're going to need it, how important does that make having the availability of health care to many Americans.
It's really the key to the entire statute. The reason that some of us, indeed most of us, have health care is precisely because we don't know when we're going to need it. That's about 85% of us. Now, there are about 15% of us who could afford health care but decide to take their chances. They really cost us a lot because they go to the emergency room and we end up paying for them. So not knowing is precisely why we all have to be in this pool, and we want the biggest pool possible because all of us will pay less. We'll spread the risk.
Since the implementation of the law, how has it impacted regular working class families?
Oh, goodness. And this is what is so attractive about the law. Do people really want to see go away the notion that there's no lifetime limit just when you need it? Do they want to see go away that a kid, especially in tough times, can't be carried on the insurance policy of the parents, or that the copay that seniors used to have to pay for mammograms and colonoscopies. They won't really see that go away. And those are things that are piling up until 2014 when all of them will be in existence, and a lot more than that I've named.
What are your constituents here in the district saying to you about the law?
My constituents strongly favor the law, even though we ourselves have had a very progressive system where we tried to cover everybody, including undocumented aliens. But I just saw a doctor who practices in the District of Columbia who says, Congresswoman, can you speak to the mayor? Because they are cutting health care so badly. And the reason they're cutting health care badly is we can't take that burden any longer. Some of it has to be taken by the federal government.
What are you expecting in the months ahead related around this issue?
Well, I spend most of my life as a constitutional lawyer, so I better watch out. I do see the new ground, and it's only slight new ground in my judgment, because it makes you pay for something. But I do believe that this bill is constitutional. And I think that there may be some parts of the court that we normally consider with the conservative majority who may agree with us.
Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton from Washington, D.C., thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, always.
We've been joined by Congressman Dennis Kucinich from Ohio. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We stand here today just across the street from the United States Supreme Court, where the justices will begin taking a look at the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. What are your initial thoughts of this process?
Well, first of all, it's a good thing that America has this debate about health care, because it's an opportunity for people to become informed about what the benefits are of the existing law and what the implications are if the law is struck down. As someone who voted for the bill, I understand the benefits as well as the flaws in it. At the same time, I believe that what this bill does is it regulates the consumption of health care, and with health care costs rising three times the rate of inflation, with health care profits soaring, if we can't find a way to regulate this for-profit system in an effective way and provide that health care can be affordable, then we are looking at the destruction of many American family budgets. And the alternative, a national health care system. So we, either way, we have to continue our efforts to try to change this system.
Congressman, you had mentioned the implications of the law being struck down. What are those implications?
Well, let's look at what some of the benefits are right now. You have children who are young people under the age of 25 who had the dependent coverage was extended to them under this law. You have children under the age of 19 who previous to the Affordable Care Act passing, they were denied insurance, and they were denied benefits based on pre-existing conditions. This bill helped them. You had medical plans before this bill passed. Medical plans were able to put lifetime dollar limits on health care benefits. They can't do that anymore because this law changed that. Before this bill passed, you had plans did not have to cover preventive care, and there was no cost sharing. Now they have to cover preventive care. Insurance companies can't rescind coverage. Yeah, and there's also limits on the ratio of premiums spent on administrative costs compared to medical costs. So there are benefits here in this bill that are in effect right now.
Do you think that those who are in opposition to this understand how important some of these benefits are to real working class families?
Well, I think the strongest opposition is coming from the insurance industry. They spent, you know, upwards of $86 million just trying to beat the bill in the first place. But in the interim period, they're the ones making a big profit. They will keep raising the rates. If we don't have any regulation, it'll be a bonanza for the insurance company. It's like with the insurance companies, heads I win, tails you lose. We have to have regulation. People may not be fully apprised of all the benefits they could get out of this bill because the debate, you know, really has centered around the individual mandate. You know, that can be arguable. Matter of fact, it's arguable at the Supreme Court this week. However, if the court comes down on the side of the ability of Congress to pass laws that regulate the consumption of health care, then it will uphold that individual mandate. If the court says it's a violation of Congress, the Commerce Clause, they'll strike it down, and I think that then could put us, and the whole bill could fail then, and that could put us on a path towards single payer. So either way, health care is never going to be the same in America as it was before this debate happened, and there's greater public awareness about the necessity of changing the healthcare system and of moving towards a point of single payer, which is what I advocate.
Strictly from the perspective of the betterment of society, how important is it for Americans to have access to affordable healthcare? How important is it to expand that opportunity to many people as possible?
I believe healthcare is a basic right. Now, there's a principle here of is there a moral obligation of a government to care for its people? I would argue yes. In an economy where one out of every $6 goes for healthcare spending. But when you consider that out of that about $2.7 trillion a year, one out of every three of those dollars goes for corporate profits, for stock options, for executive salaries, for advertising, for marketing, for the cost of paperwork. When you consider that for-profit system takes $900 billion a year out of the economy for its own purposes and not for the care for the American people, what the Supreme Court does, one way or another, is going to have monumental impact on the lives of every single American. And that's why we're here.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Congressman Dennis Kucinich from Ohio. Congressman, talk to the audience about the work that you put in and that your colleagues in Congress put in getting this bill to become a law.
Well, you know, I wasn't for it initially because I want a not-for-profit system. Eventually, I went for it to show that it's possible to have reform within the context of a for-profit system. There was a tremendous effort made to get this passed. But here we are with the Supreme Court deciding this week, or at least hearing the arguments this week about the bill. We are at a moment of decision whether or not health care reform can proceed, or whether we have to go back to square one. If this bill proceeds, then we'll look towards an implementation. If not, if any provision of it is struck down, we may see the whole bill go down. The court, on the other hand, may decide that it's not going to rule at all because there's an Anti-Injunction Act which says you can't really rule on a tax issue until it goes into effect. So they could kick the can down the road for another 3 years, during which time, more and more people will be affected by the bill.
Congressman Dennis Kucinich, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Good to be here. And if anyone needs any further information on health care and my position on it, Kucinich.us.
And we've been joined by Congresswoman Donna Christensen of the U.S. Virgin Islands. Congresswoman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So the Supreme Court is taking up the argument over the health care law.
Heading over there.
What are your expectations?
My expectations are just based on law and constitution, that the law will prevail, that we will not have it struck down, any part of it.
What is your role in this battle?
My role, well, I'm a member of the Committee on Energy and Commerce, and so I was there all through all of those hearings that we had through the markup and actually had some amendments that were passed in the bill. And also as a member of the Tri-Caucus, the Black, Hispanic, and Asian Caucus, we had some specific asks in this bill, and we were able to get many of them in that would help minorities and poor communities and rural communities beyond this consumer protections.
What were some of those asks that you got included?
Well, the expansion of community health centers, community health worker grants. We tried for something called health empowerment zones, but what we got were community transformation grants, help for, as we need to expand our health workforce, some provisions and language that would support the training of underrepresented minorities in that healthcare workforce. And there were several others.
As you work to ensure that this law stays intact in full, what do you think is the most important part of it?
Well, the one that's going to be up for debate tomorrow, the individual mandate, is very important because that really is the key to being able to provide all of the other benefits, including those that tens of millions of Americans are benefiting from today, like you cannot exclude a child who has a pre-existing disease, keeping your young people on your parents' insurance until they're 26. I had to let my daughter go at 22. The end of lifetime and lifetime limits and annual caps, the closing of the donut hole, and all of the things that we've done to strengthen Medicare, including extending its solvency for 8 years.
With your background in healthcare and having been an emergency room physician, talk about what you've seen with people coming in maybe to an emergency room almost as a last resort.
You cannot get the kind of care that you need from an emergency room. And when you talk about minorities in particular, there are studies that show that minorities die with the same injuries going into emergency room, especially Hispanics. So we don't want our people going into emergency rooms. And they need that kind of continuity of care. They need to have their care managed. And that's impossible in an having to go to emergency room. We need that coverage, that access to really comprehensive health care.
How does that change a person's life throughout the course of their life, knowing that they're covered for health care expenses? It's not something that would wipe them out financially.
Yeah, well, the security is great. And that also applies, you know, some people feel like by extending this to everyone, we're taking away something from somebody else. Well, we're not taking away anything for people who are already insured. We're making their insurance even more secure. But to know that you can get your preventive care, that you can stay healthier longer, that means you have more productive years of work and a better quality of life. That changes the whole dynamic for many, many people who have not had access to the 30-plus million people who have not had health care before.
Congresswoman, what do your constituents say to you about this law?
They want it to protect it. Even a place like the Virgin Islands, the territories, we were experiencing a lot of benefits. We have all the consumer protections. We have increases in our Medicaid funding. And we're able to have an exchange if we want one. We have to decide on that. But my constituents are glad to have this law, and they want to see it protected.
Congresswoman Donna Christensen from the U.S. Virgin Islands, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Here with Governor Tim Kaine, who is on the U.S. Senate campaign trail. Governor, as you make your way around the state, what are the voters here in Virginia telling you in terms of the role of government, federal employees, and public service?
I find a good understanding in Virginia of our connection to the federal economy. So, you know, you see things happening in other states where there's a penchant to bash, you know, public employees. I don't see that among the Virginia citizens. Virginia citizens understand our connection to the federal economy. They generally have close connections with people who they might be, you know, working as a DOD civilian at Langley Air Force Base, or they might be an EPA employee who lives in Northern Virginia and works downtown. Virginians tend to have close connections, and I think they have a balanced understanding of the responsibilities and work that federal employees do.
Do you think that understanding comes from the fact that there are so many retired and active federal employees in this area?
Yes. It would be very hard to find a Virginian who didn't have a direct family or neighborly connection with a federal employee. In Northern Virginia, certainly. In Hampton Roads, I mean, the two largest regions in Virginia, it's equally the case. And then throughout the Commonwealth, you know, I think people have that understanding too.
On day one of being in office, what would your top priority be?
Well, look, it's going to be about jobs. It's going to be about continuing to grow the economy, using some Virginia lessons. There are growth strategies that can enable us to build the economy right away. Investments in infrastructure, leveling the playing field for the true job creators, who are the small businesses and startups, and then talent strategies. You know, I'm a huge believer that if you get education, workforce development, and other talent strategies right, that's your best path to economic growth. So, you know, I'll be working with others to take an economy that is now growing, but hopefully work to accelerate the growth rate.
Governor, lastly, here in the town forum tonight, the idea of sequestration was brought up. What are your thoughts on that?
A lot of questions about sequestration, and they have an acuteness in Virginia that may even be sharper than in other states. We got to make a fundamental choice as a nation about how we deal with budgets and our deficit. One school of thought, which is the Grover Norquist school, is that you deal with a deficit 100% through cutting. If you cut expenditures only, you're making a huge mistake. You're going to devastate the economy. You're going to hurt key priorities, and you're going to particularly hurt the Virginia economy. The better way to deal with sequestration is to find a deal that, sure, makes some cuts and finds some savings, but also puts more revenue into the federal budget. And if you find that balanced approach, then, you know, we will fix our deficit situation the right way without devastating the economy. We'll save jobs by doing it.
Former Virginia Governor Tim Kaine, thank you so much for your time today.
You bet, Jason. Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by Rebuild the Dream president and co-founder Van Jones.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined now by Van Jones, president and co-founder of Rebuild the Dream. Van, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
We are here today, of course, at the Campaign for America's Futures Take Back the American Dream Conference, heading into the summertime before the November elections. What are some of the top priorities that you're looking to achieve?
Well, there are a couple of things that can get done this year and that need to get done this year. I don't think that we should just accept a sort of sit at home, do nothing Congress, while the American people are suffering. One of the big deals that we're dealing with right now is the fact that the student loans are about to double. The interest rate on the Stafford student loans is about to double from 3.4% to 6.8% interest. Who is paying 6.8% interest on anything for any product at all? But yet this next generation is going to have to cough up an additional $20 billion with a B, $20 billion with a B. That is an extraordinary figure. That is an extraordinary amount of money for the 8 million young people who will be applying for and getting those loans this year. I think we owe them better than that. That's the kind of fight of the 99% that I think Congress needs to take very seriously. I think also the fight to rescue our underwater homeowners. We have one-third of American homes are underwater financially. In other words, the mortgage costs more than the house, paying off the mortgage. If you pay off the mortgage, you're not gaining wealth, you're not building wealth, you're draining wealth, you're losing wealth. There's a bill right now in Congress that would allow American homeowners the opportunity to refinance their homes, even if they're underwater, so they can take advantage of the new lower interest rates. Those are the kinds of opportunities that this Congress should be pushed to take on. The president is on the right side of those issues. And, in fact, even Romney is on the right side of the student loan issue. And yet this Congress won't do anything. This Congress is committed, it seems to me, with the Republican-dominated Congress, to increase America's economic pain so that they can increase their political gain. They remind me of a guy sitting on a rock, looking at a lifeguard trying to save people, Obama. And they look at this, at lifeguard Obama, and they say, the more people who drown out here, the more likely it is they're going to fire the lifeguard. Maybe I can get the lifeguard's job. So rather than trying to help people, they're actually happy to see people hurting.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that there is this tremendous fundamental difference in the way to get things done and some of the solutions to these problems?
Well, you know, I just think it's one of those situations, one of those circumstances where the short-term calculation is that the more America hurts, the more people who lose their homes, the more people who lose their jobs, the more kids who can't go to college, the better it is for one political party. But it's very short-sighted because it's those kind of devastating setbacks. You know, you wipe out communities with foreclosures, you discourage young people, you throw people into both the economic but also the emotional damage of unemployment. Those things don't come back the day after the election. Those are lasting scars on the dreams of Americans, and I think that we should stop playing games with the American people. Part of the reason they think they can get away with this kind of mistreatment of Americans is because they have delivered such devastating body blows to our unions. The unions, the labor movement, has long been the champion, the stalwart defender of the interests, not just of their own members, but of middle class, working class, and poor folks as a whole. And that is the big disappointment we have right now, the big letdown we have right now, I think, is that we've stood back. You look at Wisconsin. Everything on the line in Wisconsin. My organization, Rebuild the Dream, was there. We went to Milwaukee. We tried to help with the fight. But most of the national forces stayed back. You didn't see the national Democrats go in with the money and the operation. You didn't see even the national environmental groups, national civil rights and women's groups. There were exceptions. But you didn't see that huge stand. We didn't put our maximum against their maximum. We put our minimum against their maximum. And whenever that happens, that's how we lose. When we put our maximum against their maximum, we can win. But when we put our minimum against their maximum, we lose, and we always lose. And so we can't afford to let our labor unions continue to be the punching bag and the piñata for people who have, you know, the worst intentions for this country. We can no longer let, you know, states like Wisconsin fight alone. If we let what happened in Wisconsin, happened in Ohio in November, happened in Nevada in November, happened in Florida in November, then we are going to wake up. If you think you were sad when you woke up in June with Wisconsin, wait till you wake up in November with the whole country having been taken over by this these Tea Party-style politics that are bad for not just the labor unions, but bad for the elderly, for young people, for the environment, for women, for people of color, for immigrants, for every cause and constituency that we care about is now on the chopping block when it comes to this fight in November.
A key part of this conversation is the role of government and the role of public employees in our everyday lives. Now, you touched on this a little bit in your keynote address, talking about firefighters, teachers, police officers. These are everyday heroes that we grew up idolizing. Why is it, do you think, that they are thrown into this conversation of what's right or wrong with America?
Because there is a cynical play on the part of people like Governor Christie down in New Jersey and other places that says, well, surely we know that if we just come right out and say we want to make sure that our teachers don't have enough money, we want to make sure that our teachers are teaching 35, 40 kids in the classroom with six books and no chalk, that there will be a pushback. And so what they first have to do is to trigger another part of the American mind, which is this idea of resentment. And so what they're doing to get past the American people an agenda that is clearly to the detriment of our children and our neighborhoods is to say, well, these people make more money than you do. They have better retirement than you do. They have better pensions than you do. They have better health care than you do. Shouldn't we tear them down to your level or below your level? As opposed to saying, well, why don't we try to build everybody up? When people are afraid and when people are under attack, there is a tendency for people to shrink at first into a smaller politics, into a smaller vision. Real leadership is helping people to recognize in a moment like this, the worst thing you can do is turn on each other. The best thing you can do is turn to each other. And that is the great opportunity that we have, I think, is to make this election be about that key question. Are we going to turn on each other or to each other? If we turn to each other, we can find a way forward. We should be trying to lift the wages and benefits of all American workers, and we can certainly do that. America's not broke. We're richest country in the history of the world, and the corporations are sitting on piles and piles of cash that they won't spend. And so the idea that we should all try to make each other suffer worse rather than insisting that 100% of Americans, including the wealthy, participate in making us all better off, that's wrongheaded. That's why I appreciate so much, not just now, but you know, historically, the role of our labor unions to move us in a more positive direction. And it would be very difficult, I think, to even imagine how the American dream would have gotten built, how the American middle class would have gotten built, if we did not have labor unions sticking up, not just for their members, but for all of us.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Van Jones, the president and co-founder of Rebuild the Dream. Van, you had talked not only about winning politically in November, but also economically in December. What are the differences there? What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that there's going to be a big budget battle during the lame duck session of Congress, and it will probably go into January, even February. But the terms of the debate will be, should we have massive austerity, massive destruction raining down on ordinary people as we try to balance the budget by taking things away from already struggling neighborhoods, communities, families, or will we have a more actually balanced and fair approach where those who benefited from the bailouts and the tax breaks and the bonuses over the past 10 and 20 years start to pay America back and start to begin to balance the books by putting back on the table the things they took off the table. And the Bush tax cuts are the number one example of that and symbol of that. But there are many advantages that the big global corporations have. There are many advantages that the super rich have that should be taken away. Why are we still giving billions and billions of dollars in tax breaks to the big oil companies, to the big energy companies? They are the most profitable companies in the history of humanity. Why do they need tax breaks? And yet we can't even get a bill through Congress right now to give tax breaks to small businesses or to help students go to college. So what we've got to be able to do is to turn to these big global corporations, to turn to the wealthy who we're so proud of. They've done well in the country. But say to them, if you do well in America, you've got to do well by America. And that means you've got to create good jobs here, not be rewarded for taking jobs out of the country. And you've got to pay your taxes here and quit complaining about it. Have the class and the decency to do what your parents did and your grandparents did. They were proud to pay their taxes and proud to help America stay strong, both abroad but also at home. And we've got to be able to make that the big moral issue of this fight.
Many times when talking about elections, we hear that the election is the most important one of our lifetimes, and everyone that comes along is increasingly more and more important. What's at stake in this election in 2012?
Well, I think, you know, it is in fact the case that the stakes go up in each one of these elections, partly because we keep kicking the can down the road in terms of how are we going to be a first-rate country or are we going to be a third-rate country? That is a big question. Are we going to be a country that follows a formula that our parents laid down, that our grandparents laid down and fought for, where we invest in infrastructure, where we invest in people? We educated an entire generation of Americans in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. Why? Because it was good for that individual kid's career. You know, why should I have to pay more taxes to send your kid to college? No, that was not how our parents and grandparents thought about it. They were pretty smart folks, and they said, this is not about any individual kid's career. They said, this is about the country. We want to have a whole generation of really smart Americans to outcompete the world and make sure that we've got a wealthy country, and that is the right formula. And so, our big, I think, challenge now going forward is to remember how this house got built. This house wasn't built with a wrecking ball. This house wasn't built with people turning on each other. This house was built by us coming together and laying a foundation, creating world-class infrastructure, creating a world-class, well-trained workforce so we could outcompete the world and lead the world both in economic performance but also in labor standards, environmental standards, civil rights standards. That is who we are as a nation. And those people who are trying to drag us backwards have benefited by having the can kicked down the road and kicked down the road and kicked down the road while the deficit gets bigger and bigger and the tax breaks keep getting extended and we keep putting off the big decisions and we also keep these dumb wars going. And we got now our militaries all around the world and we're draining America's wealth in every country in the world, doing nation building everywhere but here. And so it is, in fact, ironic that the stakes do go up in every election. But here's what I honestly believe. I don't think we can keep kicking the can down the road anymore. I think that we are now at a place where between 2012 and 2014, we're going to make the fundamental decisions about the economy. All right, what is going to be the mix between the wealthy and those who've done well in America, paying America back, versus imposing more pain and pulling more blood out of the already suffering, collapsing middle class, struggling working folks and poor folks. I think that gets resolved. I don't think that we can go much longer without resolving it. And what we know is that our opponents have a plan. Our opponents have a plan. It's called the Ryan budget. And the Ryan budget would do more damage to American infrastructure than our worst enemies could ever think up. Trillions of dollars of damage and cuts, all to protect the wealthiest people ever born from having to pay a penny more in taxes. I think that's immoral. I think it's wrong. And I do think that this election will set the stage to resolve for the next 10 to 20 years the economic direction. Some elections are about the foreign policy direction, where we're going to be in the world. That was certainly true in 2004. But in 2012, this is a fundamental vote about the kind of economy that we're going to have, whether we're going to have a middle class, whether we're going to have an opportunity for the next generation to have American dreams that they can pursue, or whether we're going to be living in an American nightmare for the 99%.
You mentioned in your keynote address not only in order to get some of these wins politically and economically that there needs to be a movement in the streets as well as a media strategy. Is there enough time before November to accomplish that? And if so, how does it get done?
You know, the thing about it is there's always enough time if we do everything we're supposed to do. There's always enough time. You've seen these things turn on a dime. I remember when everybody said it was impossible for Barack Obama to become president. He's not well known. He's got a Muslim last name. He's African American. Every problem in the world. And he came out of nowhere and changed history. And I remember when people said that Obama, with his 60 votes in the Senate and Nancy Pelosi running the House, would be this unstoppable juggernaut. And then the Tea Party came seemingly out of nowhere and put a checkmate on that. And then people say, well, it's just going to be austerity and Tea Party politics forever, and nobody's going to be able to raise any progressive ideas. And then here comes Occupy Wall Street. I think that the tendency for liberals, unfortunately, is to swing from denial, everything's fine, no problem, to despair, and skip the fight in the middle. And we are right now at the moment where what matters is the fight in the middle. We have enough social capital, social media, independent media like this and others to amplify our voice. And we have enough good people. The people who voted in 2008, if we get all those people to vote again or any fraction of it, we will win. But the question is, are we going to sit on our hands and do our opponents' jobs for them by demobilizing and demoralizing ourselves and handing the country over to the Tea Party? I don't think we can afford to do that.
Van Jones, president and co-founder of Rebuild the Dream. Van, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. Senator, welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be with you. It's really nice to be here and see so many people come to Washington to get their voices heard, which is important.
And of course, we're here today at AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference. What's the main point that you would like to get across today?
Well, I really want the federal workers to know that what they do is critically important to our country. They're on the front lines of providing public service, and the services they provide and protecting our food supply and keeping us safe and dealing with innovation and technology and research and public safety. The list goes on and on and on. It's critically important to our nation. They do their jobs very well. We're asking them to do more with less resources. They've already been asked to sacrifice to help balance our budget. So our federal workforce has been on the front lines, and the way they're being demonized by groups in Washington is absolutely outrageous. So I want them to know I appreciate what they do every day. I'm going to be fighting to make sure that we do what's right and stop making the federal workers the scapegoats for our national problems.
Senator, what are the consequences of doing more with less or continuing to do more with less?
Well, ultimately, you see it in the services. My office gets phone calls from people who are trying to get their disability determinations at the Social Security Administration. Well, there's less people to do that work, so it's going to take a longer period of time. The Americans want to make sure that our borders are protected and are safe. Well, there's less federal workers doing that work. They want to make sure that we have the economy that can grow as far as jobs are concerned. Well, a lot of that basic research and a lot of the technology is done by federal workforce. With fewer there, it's going to take a lot longer to get these answers to help the job creation. So it's going to be services to the people in this country who expect to get their Social Security checks or have their Medicare payments processed on time. There's going to be a consequence to that. But there also will be a consequence to this nation being as competitive as we need to be to provide the services that people expect. All that will suffer because we, quite frankly, just don't have enough people doing the work.
Senator, you mentioned some of the attacks against federal workers in Washington. As you're fighting back against those attacks on behalf of federal workers, do you think that people realize that this is about public service, that if you cut more jobs, if you cut more positions, ultimately the impact is going to be felt by the American people?
Well, there's this mentality in Washington that we don't need government. So I think to a large measure, the attack on the federal workforce is an attack on government. And it's interesting, the people who are making these attacks are ones who benefit from governmental services. It's their children who are getting the educational services. It's their parents that are getting the Medicare services for their needs. It's their families that want these services. So I think we have to continue to make this point. When you look at the type of sacrifices our federal workforce are currently making, the fact that they've already had a two-year pay freeze, I think more and more people in this country are going to say, wait a minute, let's do what's right, let's do what's fair. wasn't our federal workforce that caused our fiscal problems. It was irresponsible policies in the previous administration that led us into two wars and cut taxes. That's the cause of our deficits, not the federal workforce.
And so ultimately, then, what's the best way to balance the country's budget once again?
We need a balanced approach to balance the budget. It's very important that we get our budget into better balance. I'm one of those who believe in the so-called grand bargain. Let's really get it done. And all of us need to be part of it. But quite frankly, you can't do it without revenues. Revenues are a historically low level. We've got to close those loopholes, and those who are the most well off have to pay their fair share of taxes. So we need the revenues, but we also have to reduce spending. And the area where we think we really need to reduce spending are areas that have grown by the largest amount, such as health care costs. Well, we took a major step to do that in the last Congress with the health reform. Now we need to implement it to make sure that we get people out of emergency rooms who shouldn't be there, that we have the right protocols as far as preventive care is concerned, wellness programs. All that can help save the health care dollars, not just for the federal taxpayer, but for the American people.
Let's talk a little bit about health care reform a little more in detail. Of course, initially started rolling out at the beginning of 2011, 2014, even more comes in to play. What excites you the most about the Affordable Care Act?
I think the most important thing is delivery system reform. That means really doing things more efficiently, reducing the amount of hospital infection rates, which will really reduce costs. There are doctors at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore who estimate that that change alone could save as much as $300 billion over the next 10 years. And there's huge savings. Getting people to take care of themselves after they're discharged from hospitals so that we don't have readmissions to hospitals. Better use of technology so that we can avoid mistake of medical protocols. All of that will help save money. Taking on the insurance companies so they stop these abusive practices of saying because you're a woman and had a baby, that's a pre-existing condition. Those types of crazy things should have had no place in our healthcare system. I think all that means that we're going to have a much more rational system, a less costly system, but a more effective system.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Senator Ben Cardin. Senator, when you go around the state of Maryland and you talk to people about the Affordable Care Act point by point, do you find more buy-in whenever people are educated about some of these particulars that the law provides?
Oh, absolutely. I've been to all parts of Maryland, some of the most conservative areas, which you would think would have some problems with the legislation. But once I explained that we're making Medicare stronger, we extended the solvency for 10 years. We're now providing an annual wellness exam to our seniors, no co-pays on preventive care. When I explain to small business owners who currently pay maybe 20% more for the same coverage, will finally be able to get insurance at a comparable price as larger companies, they really start to listen and say, hey, that's not a bad idea. Or we start talking about how insurance companies can no longer use pre-existing conditions and they have to pay a certain amount of the premium dollar out in benefits. All that are very popular things to the people in Maryland and all parts of Maryland, and I think all parts of our nation. So I think they understand it and they get it and they want us to improve upon it. I think the frustrating part is I acknowledge that we can do better. We really want to build on what was done. Unfortunately, the current climate, particularly in the House of Representatives, where the Tea Party has this great influence, so we can't take up health care. All they want to do is try to repeal what was done in the previous Congress. So we're wasting time in trying to get things better for the people in this country.
Senator, many in the press have suggested a very contentious climate in Washington, parties not being able to work together. Do you see that as a reality, or is it different when you work with your colleagues from across the aisle? Do you find more collaboration, or are those suggestions true that it is more
there's
contentious?
There's no question that there's a real divide in Washington. There's no question that the Tea Party influence on the Republican Party, particularly in the House, has had a major impact on us moving forward and solving problems. You know, I believe in the principles of the Democratic Party in which I was elected. I'm proud to be a Democrat in the United States Senate. But I believe when elections are over, you got to sit down and work together. You got to work across party line, get things done for the good of the country. So in the Senate, I've worked with Republicans on environmental issues. Senator Lamar Alexander, a Republican from Tennessee, and I have worked together on mountaintop removal. I've worked with Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, to deal with some foreign policy issues. Olympia Snow, a Republican from Maine. I've worked on small business issues. So it's important that Democrats and Republicans work together to get things done. And I think we're getting some of that, but not enough. And there's no question that the major problems of this country need to be dealt with. The private sector needs predictability. The American people need predictability. And we've got to deal with our budget deficit. We have to give invest in our future. We've got to get our tax code so the people understand the incentives that are there, not just on a temporary basis, so they know how to plan. These are things that should be gotten done.
In today's environment, when you're working really hard to repair the economy and put the American people in a good position, many times the conversation comes to cutting programs. Talk a little bit about the danger of cutting programs such as Social Security, such as Medicare, Medicaid. What do they really mean to people?
Well, they're lifelines. It's how seniors can live with dignity. I mean, before we had Social Security and Medicare, our seniors most lived in poverty. A large number lived in poverty. We've reduced that. So this is about dignity. It's about the values of America. What do we believe in? Do we want to make sure that everyone gets quality health care that's affordable? Well, that's what Medicare does. Do we want to make sure that there's a safety net so that people in their, as they live longer, have an income source? That's what Social Security does. Social Security is the only lifetime, inflation-proof, guaranteed annuitant that you can count on. You can't outlive your Social Security. Thank goodness. You know, many people plan on, you know, when they're 65 and they retire, they say, well, I'm going to live 20 more years. They plan on their income. They're 85. They're still healthy. And their business that they sold, all that money is gone. They didn't have Social Security. They literally would be living on the streets. So these are programs that speak to American values. And quite frankly, we're going to fight to maintain those programs. We're not going to let anyone mess up those important programs that speak to American values and the dignity of our seniors.
And ultimately, I would imagine as a representative of the people that you would be happy to raise the standard of living for all Americans through a program like a Social Security to make sure that they do have their dignity and are able to maintain some independence.
Well, absolutely. You know, when we talk about investing in America's future, we want to invest in our children, make sure they have the best schools, the best education, the best training. We want to invest in our infrastructure, that is our roads, our bridges, our water systems, our energy systems, so that we can compete with any country in the world, so that we have the great jobs here in America. We think we can not only create jobs in the high-tech and the internet-type jobs, but we can traditional manufacturing do well. So we want all those jobs here in America. We think we can make it in America. Well, you can make it as an individual. You can make it as a manufacturer. And that's where America's future needs to be. We want our economy to grow for all, but we're not going to do it sacrificing our seniors or sacrificing our young people. We want to make sure that we invest in the right programs for America's future.
As you look forward into 2012 now, what are some of your top priorities?
Clearly, number one priority is job creation. I want to make sure that we rebuild America to be competitive. That means I want a transportation programs that make sense and energy programs. We need to be energy independent. We can get there. So let's invest in an energy policy that makes sense, that will create jobs here in America, that will allow us to be secure from the intimidation of other countries who we depend upon for their energy. Let's get off that dependency, and let's be a better international country as far as our environment is concerned. All that can be done by investing in those types of programs. So you know, my top priority is for America to invest, to continue its strength, to get its budget into better balance, and quite frankly, to respect all, including our federal workforce.
Senator Ben Cardin from Maryland, we appreciate your time and your work on behalf of federal employees.
My pleasure. Great to be with you. Thanks.
Thank you to our guests this week, U.S. Representatives Eleanor Holmes Norton of the District of Columbia, Donna Christensen of the U.S. Virgin Islands, and former Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. Also thank you to Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, Rebuild the Dream President and Co-Founder Van Jones, and Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you by the American Federation of Government Employees. WFED Washington, WW.